So if I extracted all the blood sugar out of your bloodstream, it would sit in a teaspoon. And anything above that, your body's going to respond to try and get it out of the bloodstream. So it's going to respond with insulin. So if you have a soda that might have 13 to 17 teaspoons in it, or a chocolate cake or brownie, I don't even know how many sugar, you know, servings are in that, you're going to get this wild spike and your body's going to respond. So we get that sort of amplifying mood swings and energy dips that are already happening because we have changes in our hormones. And so we're going to have mood and energy fluctuations. Ladies, are you ready to take control of your menopause journey? Introducing Mastering the Pause, the ultimate ebook that empowers you with the knowledge and tools to navigate this transformative phase with confidence and grace. Packed with expert guidance on hormone replacement, essential lab tests, personalized diet and lifestyle strategies, this book is your secret weapon to combat menopause-related challenges. Discover how to maintain a healthy metabolism, ward off belly fat, and embrace this new chapter of your life. Download your copy now at guide.hormoneshelp.com. That's guide.hormoneshelp.com. And let's make this a smooth and informed menopause transition today. So I'm breaking up. Yeah, it's time. Nope, I'm not breaking up my relationship. I'm not breaking up with anything other than sugar. So today I'm going to go into it on Menopause Mastery. We're going to talk about why it's time for you to break up with sugar, and especially how it plays a role in all the symptoms and concerns with menopause and perimenopause, even if you're on the other side of it. So let's dig in. So like I said, the relationship between sugar intake and menopause is actually multifaceted. And it is a subject that encompasses all kinds of various aspects of women's health, including the hormone fluctuations themselves. Obviously, metabolic changes, I think we have all completely identified that especially added sugar to the diet is going to cause metabolic damage. And obviously, the overall well-being during the menopause transition and beyond. So when we look at the research, it obviously focuses on diet, particularly the extra sugar consumption that's been added to foods and the impact of symptoms. So we're going to go into those today and how that may be making your symptoms of menopause way worse. And then we're going to go into the conversation about developing conditions, right? How menopause conditions or the diseases associated with menopause, like cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis, is exacerbated, obviously, by menopause. But guess what? Sugar may make them worse. So let's dig in and really go into it. So first off, how does high sugar contribute to your menopausal symptoms? So high sugar can exacerbate menopausal symptoms such as hot flashes and mood swings. A lot of the research looking at this is probably because of the impact of sugar on the actual hormone imbalances. You know, anytime you take in something like sugar, right, especially refined sugar, you're going to create a hormonal surge of insulin. And in order to keep that blood glucose level balanced. And the studies really show that if we are taking in sugar, we're going to create a larger fluctuation of blood sugar itself and insulin, and that cortisol often follows with it. And between those hormones, we see a change in hypothalamic control, which is, think of that as sort of your thermostatic control in the brain. And we're going to see an increase of hot flashes in particular. Now, any parent will tell you, if they gave sugar to their small children, they saw the impact of sugar on behavior and mood. So we all have known for a very long time that sugar has the impact both of euphoric feelings when you first get it, and then the horrifying crash, right? Much like other street drugs. Part of that is because sugar actually hits the opiate receptors in the brain, and it creates this surge of things like dopamine and serotonin, but they're very short-lived. And so when insulin gets it out of the system and drops it back down to normal, then you see this subsequent drop and you see this kind of loss of dopamine and serotonin. What's interesting is when you look at the DNA data, so the genetics data, some of us, depending on our genetics for how we both recycle and rebuild these neurotransmitters, things like co-methyltransferase, methylation, the DRD2 receptors for dopamine, the MAO receptors, all of these have to do with how our body manages serotonin and dopamine. Depending on your combination, you're going to feel this more acutely if you're mutated in some of those genes. So some people feel this more than others. So again, if I'm going to get increased in hot flashes and mood swings, and then if I've got my estrogen, you know, basically fluctuating wildly, it's going to create that variation even greater. And Kravitz and Gantz did a study in 2015 looking at that, and they looked at the importance of dietary patterns in menopausal symptoms. And the people that had diets with higher refined sugars had higher scores on outcome scores, so basically poorer quality of life. So menopause is obviously associated too with metabolic syndrome, right? So metabolic syndrome is a clustering of symptoms. At its core is insulin resistance, but metabolic syndrome also drives weight gain, high cholesterol, right? High LDL, higher cholesterol levels, potentially contributing to lower HDL to LDL cholesterol ratio, higher triglycerides. We also see an increased risk of blood pressure and stroke. And underlying all of metabolic syndrome is an increase in visceral fat, which is the body fat that's between your muscle and your organs. And when you get more visceral fat, we get more inflammatory cytokine activity and our increased risk for type 2 diabetes. So higher sugar consumption is a well-known risk factor for developing metabolic syndrome due to that role in weight gain. Again, the triglycerides playing a role, all of that. So when you look at that, you go, okay, the average woman will gain 10 to 15% of their body weight as they go through menopause. That's what the stats show. And so there's a huge interplay between insulin resistance and estrogen. So many of us, when we're in that period before we go through complete menopause, we have wild fluctuation, what I like to call the ketchup bottle effect of estrogen. So if you've never heard me say that before, when you're in your 20s and 30s and you go to squeeze out your ketchup bottle onto your organic, no gluten containing hot dog, your S of your ketchup is perfect, right? It's perfect. It's balanced. It's even. When you get into perimenopause, it's like the jug is half empty. So you're shaking it and you go to squeeze it. Nothing comes out. You squeeze it again and it splats. So when we have those wild hormone fluctuations, what we see is we're in an estrogen dominant state in many cases where progesterone, the other hormone, has declined. And so we get greater estrogen, which leads to more insulin resistance. So we have estrogen contributing. And then when it's fluctuating wildly, we see greater movement as well. So when we get into menopause, we're going to see that. And that people who have a higher dietary intake of sugar see more metabolic syndrome, more risk for type 2 diabetes, and greater visceral fat increase and weight gain. And again, it's pretty common if we know that the average woman's going to gain 10 to 15% of their body weight just because of the loss of estrogen. The other side of that is estrogen plays a contributory role in helping your body take glucose, which is your blood sugar. Once it's been pushed across the cell wall by insulin, the GLUT4 transporter, which is sort of passive, helps drag that sugar very slowly to the powerhouse. Well, estrogen influences the speed in which that works. So we have a direct relationship to the loss of estrogen. And then estrogen also impacts mitochondrial function, which is your powerhouse. And so we have a couple things that are happening just because of estrogen fluctuations and then the loss of estrogen, which on average is going to cause weight gain. So if you're a woman who eats more refined sugar, more refined foods, then you're going to see an increased potential for weight gain, particularly if you're more sedentary. And again, a lot of that is happening because we are insulin resistant. Now, if you look at the stats and you look at what the research shows, we are estimating today that 88% of the adult community in the United States have some degree of insulin resistance. Okay, that is astronomical, right? So that means that most all of us are somewhere on that continuum. And a lot of it is the dietary intake, but you've got things like cortisol and your other hormones that are contributing. So it's huge. And so let's go into the other side, right? So insulin resistance, risk for type 2 diabetes, the increase in metabolic syndrome risk, and then the change in estrogen and progesterone levels all interplay, right? And then those are going to create greater symptoms. Well, sugar, especially refined sugar, can initiate pro-inflammatory activity, right? So the more sugar I eat, the more inflammation we have. So the reality is not only is menopause an inflammatory condition, But all diseases are inflammatory diseases. Doesn't matter what you've been labeled with as a diagnosis, they all have an inflammatory component. So if my diet is contributing to that because it's got a high amount of refined foods or sugar, I'm creating unnecessary inflammation that is already going to contribute to a body that is going towards an inflammatory response because my hormones are now declining. So sugar, especially refined sugar, initiates that response. Chronic inflammation is associated with the risks of things like cardiovascular disease, dementia, and osteoporosis. And so not only do we see those disease risks go up, but just sugar and the inflammatory response will increase your symptoms of hot flashes, night sweats, fatigue, weight gain, right? Even joint pain. My last podcast was talking about joint pain. The simple fact is this sugar is going to increase that risk as well, because if I'm already having an inflammatory response in my joints because of the loss of estrogen and the increased inflammatory cytokine activity in that joint, sugar is going to contribute. I've had lots and lots of women. I can even tell you about a woman, her name was Sammy, and she came in and her knees would get swelling, right? So both of her knees, but particularly her right one, would get swelling around the knee, and even things that felt like fluid buildup, they felt hot. And she had been told that she was going to need a knee replacement, and she really didn't want to do that. You know, also, the simple fact is, think of a knee replacement or a hip replacement or any kind of bone replacement. It's kind of like getting tires. They don't last for a lifetime. So the longer you can put off getting a replacement or never have it, the better off you are. And sometimes we have to do that. I've had a friend that recently had a hip replacement, and he was in excruciating pain. Right. But the reality is, if you get something done at like 45, the likelihood is somewhere along the way, maybe at 60, 65, you may have to do it again. And that is not ideal. The less we can go under the knife, the better. Well, so that was Sammy's thing. Sammy goes, oh my gosh, Betty, I do not want to have a joint replacement. At the time, she was like 48, and she just kind of could see the writing on the wall. And so what we did is we just did a massive sort of sugar breakup diet. And we did an elimination diet. We did some other nutrients and things to really help her out. And lo and behold, in 12 weeks, her joint pain went in her knees went from an average of an 8 or a 9. She was taking NSAIDs and other pain relievers on a regular basis, went from an 8 to a 9 to an average of a 2, right? And then she noticed that when she went on a bender on the weekend and like went out with girlfriends, had a bunch of chocolate and wine, her knee pain came back. Right. So what does that tell you? That tells you that the inflammatory response was being directly driven by the food she was taking in. It's nothing magical. It's sugar is inflammatory. Right. So think about it that way. We don't want the inflammatory stuff. Obviously, sugar, refined sugar, processed foods contributes to weight gain. And it contributes not only to the fat, but we get more visceral fat. So we get more fat underneath the muscle, in between the organs, which increases your risk of all-cause mortality because organs themselves get fat, like the liver, and it leads to more fat accumulation all over the place, right? So if I already am collecting it on my hips and thighs, which is where we tend to collect it as women when we have hormones, then I start collecting it around the midsection, then we get that sort of broadening of the belly fat, right? And so all of our clothes fit differently, but then our risk for all metabolic diseases are impaired. Now, what that also does is increase your insulin resistance, and it also messes with a hormone called leptin. And visceral fat, the fat underneath your muscle, close to your organs, makes a hormone called leptin. All the other fat does too, but particularly visceral fat seems to be very active. Leptin is a hormone that regulates energy balance by telling your brain whether you need to burn fat or not. So if I have menopause with the loss of estrogen, so my body doesn't burn fat as efficiently, I have the body becoming more insulin resistant because of menopause, I also have a increase in leptin, I'm going to get this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that I'm going to start having more and more weight gain, more and more fatigue, more and more of the things I don't want. And sugar drives a primary mood or a primary part of that scenario. Right. So sugar is a driver. Now, the other thing we see is obviously mood and energy fluctuations. So I mentioned it earlier, but I want to make sure I dig into this. So serotonin is our happy neurotransmitter or brain chemistry. Don't think of it as excitement. That's really dopamine. Dopamine is anticipation, excitement, thrill. Serotonin's like kumbaya. Sugar temporarily boosts serotonin production. And so we get this small sort of boost in well-being and sort of happiness. But the problem is that rapid drop that occurs because insulin is going to look at it and say, oh, wow, that went way too high. That's not safe, right? Because in a natural human body, in an adult human, we have about a teaspoon. So if I extracted all the blood sugar out of your bloodstream, it would sit in a teaspoon. And anything above that, your body's going to respond to try and get it out of the bloodstream. So it's going to respond with insulin. So if you have a soda that might have 13 to 17 teaspoons in it, or a chocolate cake or brownie, I don't even know how many sugar, you know, servings are in that, you're going to get this wild spike and your body's going to respond. So we get that sort of amplifying mood swings and energy dips that are already happening because we have changes in our hormones. And so we're going to have mood and energy fluctuations. And then probably one of the other more insidious things, and this is one of the primary drivers of aging, cardiovascular disease risk, osteoporosis, inflammatory diseases, Alzheimer's, and even contributes to things like cancer, is the increase in free radical production and oxidative stress. So think of free radicals and oxidative stress as your body rusting more rapidly. So as we age, we rust more rapidly. And so every disease has some sort of activity. Well, sugar drives oxidative stress in everybody. It's going to drive oxidative stress. So if I'm intaking a lot of sugar and then going through menopause, we lose estrogen and progesterone, our oxidative stress is going to go up, which means all cause risk for mortality, and the ravages of aging are all now here. So let's talk about how sugar got here. Like, how did we get so much damn sugar in our diet? So up until really, you know, modern food processing, which is really around the 1800s and late 1800s and early 1900s, the average human did not eat that much sugar. And like, my grandmother was born in the late 1890s. Okay, she was 90 years old when I was 16. And, you know, I remember she had this little sugar bowl on her counter, you know, and she would put like a little sugar in something. But she was 100% aware of all the sugar she ingested, right? Most of her food was natural. She had a little bit of bread, right? She ate a little bread. Matter of fact, she made her own like little ice cream where she controlled how much sugar was in it. She'd have like a little quarter cup every night. But she took in very small amounts, very teaspoons a day. Now, you know, depending on what study you read, it's anywhere from, you know, 150 pounds or more, depending on who you look at. Some people estimate even as much as, you know, 200, 250 pounds of sugar if we were to take it out and separate it. Now, I don't know about you, but none of us really have sugar bowls on our table. I haven't seen it. I know it's not in my house. So our sugar is added to a lot of things that we may not even think about it, right? So your processed foods, all the stuff in the middle of the grocery store, right? So here's your way out. All your processed, all the stuff that has had man manipulate it, the vast majority, if not all of it, contains some sort of sugar. And that is because sugar is a preservative, right? Sugar helps something be more shelf stable for a longer period of time. So in many cases, your bread and stuff like that, actually one of the top three ingredients is going to be a sugar component because it allows it to sit on that shelf for eons, right? So sugar is a preservative, and so it's in there. Sugar is hidden in almost all of those foods because it also hits your opiate receptors in the brain, right? So you have to recognize our brain is wired for what I call these high-ticket foods, because back in the hunter-gatherer time periods or even early agriculture, food was not plentiful. So our bodies are hardwired to want the things that put on body fat, that help satiate. And so we are going against nature when we don't eat foods that satiate. But when we get a little bit of it, we get extraordinary impact to our brain chemistry and our body chemistry that drive us towards more of it. So we have to understand that we're fighting against our biology. So the more I engage in eating sugar, the more sugar I want. So, you know, even looking at, they've done studies looking at breakfast intake. So the people that eat a high carbohydrate breakfast, let's say they're doing, you know, toast or they're doing oatmeal and they aren't eating protein with it, the blood sugar variability, particularly in people who are pre-diabetic and diabetic, is more widely diffuse and all over the place. We have less blood sugar control over the course of the day than if we had protein at that meal. Protein is more satiating, it helps keep the blood sugar balanced longer, and we see a better overall kind of blood sugar effect, right? So if I'm eating a really high carb breakfast, guess what? I'm going to want a Frappuccino something later on that day. After dinner, I'm going to want a little something sweet after dinner. And then when everybody goes to bed, I'm going to have the mommy hour and I'm going to have a glass of wine because my body is sort of primed for it and it's constantly sort of chasing that sugar high, right? So we have to understand that we're also hardwired to want those things. So the thing that I think is most insidious, particularly as women, many of us have dieted. We grew up in a diet culture. And so we get upset with ourselves because we feel like we should have this perfect willpower that, you know, can basically out-muscle any sort of advertising, you know, experience that we're having. So we have, I think you need to give yourself a little bit of grace and understand that we have a genetic propensity for this, or we are wired for high-ticket food. And so the less we are around it, the better. So when you look at your plate and you look at what am I eating, I'm not saying don't ever eat some sort of sweet something or other, because I also recognize that's not going to happen, right? But it's all about putting it in perspective. So if I look at a plate, right? So I mean, as a fellow author, and I have lots of friends that are authors, I don't think we need to have a book when we go to the grocery store to figure out how to eat. I think as an industry, we have overcomplicated this and we have made people scared of food, and or they just say, forget it. They throw their hands up in the air and they're just like, I'm going to pound whatever I want to eat. So the reality is, if you look at all the dietary recommendations, right, if you were to go through all of the ones that have sound research, there's some commonality between most all of them, right? Every once in a while, you get the crazy outlier diets. And I'm not saying crazy that the diets are always crazy, but you've got the outliers like the carnivore and or the, you know, hardcore ketogenic diet. Those things are different, right? They're extreme versions. They're not lifestyle diets. I think the data will bear that out. Actually, in a lot of cases, it already has. Taking all food groups out or a significant amount of food groups out don't necessarily create a body that's healthy all the time. But if you were to take all those diets and sort of weave them together, you're like, okay, Betty, I recognize I do not want to be inflamed. I don't want to have oxidative stress. I don't want to be moody. I don't want to have hot swings. I don't want to be in pain. I don't want, you know, to have weight gain and metabolic syndrome. I need to cut the sugar. So let's look at a plate. If I take half of my plate and I look at it, number one, it should probably be a salad plate instead of the gigantic dinner plates that we used to do. Just so you know, we have upsized all of our plates and they're very big. If you're working on portion size, sometimes just having what was legitimately a dinner plate, right, is a 12-inch plate, not a 16 or an 18-inch. So, but a half of my plate needs to be things that are non-starchy and what I love to just refer to as, and things that grow above ground. Right? You don't see toast growing on stalks. You don't see pasta growing on stalks. The things that grow above ground, your leafy stuff, your tomatoes, your onions, well, they don't really grow above ground, but they have their greens, your peppers, all of those foods have very low carbohydrate content, very high fiber content, which is great for your microbiome, and phytonutrient content, which are antioxidants and also food sources for your microbiome. If half of your plate is filled with that stuff, right? They're almost zero calories by the time you get to the net fiber count, right? Those foods are going to give you nourishment without a bunch of carbohydrates. They are carbs. Same with fruits. Fruits come with their natural fiber. Some are higher in natural sugars, but generally speaking, fruits, you know, a half cup of fruit at a meal is absolutely appropriate, right? So half of a plate is going to be something non-starchy and grows above ground. Now, the other quarter of the plate, the other quarter is going to be your animal protein or your proteins. If you're a vegetarian, vegan, you're going to get some sort of protein, but you need protein on the plate that so you can get your proteins. Proteins are absolutely required. They're an essential nutrient. They also keep your blood sugar balanced. They help your body create things like enzymes and hormones and build muscle and all that other stuff. We need protein, right? So I need at least a quarter of the plate is at protein, right? So that I need that. The other quarter of the plate, even if I were just to look at it and say, okay, I'm not talking to endurance athletes. I'm not talking to the person that does 3-a-day fitness. I'm talking to the average female that is trying to be healthier. That other quarter of the plate is going to be about a half cup to up to a cup of something starchy, right? If you lean into starchy stuff like legumes, whole grains if you eat them, right? We don't see pasta. I don't care if it said it was created in whole grains. We have powdered it and created a pasta out of it. It is no longer a whole grain, right? In its natural form. potatoes, sweet potatoes, butternut squash, your legumes, black beans, lentils, those kind of things. They are all somewhat interchangeable when you look at the fiber to carbohydrate content. There'll be small variability, but honestly, if I have a little bit of that at a meal, I'm getting some carbs, I'm getting slow burning carbs, I'm getting the stuff that I need to help my body have a balanced blood sugar. If I do that and I stay away from the processed foods, I have to withdraw from it. Most people go through withdrawal. When you stop eating sugar, you're going to go through an opiate withdrawal that is going to last a couple days, but then you're going to feel better, right? Energy comes up. The first couple days, you might feel grouchy and moody. But as you come off of all that sugar, you're going to feel so much better. And then if you just do that consistently, yeah, you can have a little piece of dark chocolate. Yeah, you can go out every once in a while with your girlfriend and have a glass of red wine or whatever and not feel this crazy ill effect. But if you're shopping in the grocery store in that midsection and you're falling for the marketing, you're getting processed carbohydrate that turns to sugar very rapidly because it's been made into a cracker, a cookie, a pasta, a bread, or you're going to get the sugar that's also been added to it and it's going to make you all over the place and make your symptoms worse, right? So think about it that way. Know that you're going to go through a little bit of a detox. Know that you're going to have a little bit of a withdrawal. But as soon as you're over that hump, within about a week to 10 days, you feel so much better. And what's going to happen is, hey, our insulin levels are going to get more controlled. Hey, our inflammatory cytokines and oxidative stress is going to get better. Hey, our risk for type 2 diabetes, inflammation, cardiovascular disease, even cancer. The reality is sugar intake and obesity have a greater risk for cancer than any hormone replacement. Alcohol consumption of sugar has a greater risk for breast cancer than any hormone replacement. So if I can control my sugar, I'm going to actually reduce my risk for all-cause mortality at the same time. And I will probably lose weight. I will probably feel better. Who knows? Maybe I'm not going to get hormonal acne. Yeah, some women get hormonal acne at menopause, and it is not fun, right? So I'm going to feel so much better. So think about it. Think about all those things and then make the decision to break up with sugar because it's like a bad boyfriend that shows up, gaslights you, and then leaves every night, leaves you crying on the couch. You no longer want sugar in your life. So I hope that you found this helpful on Menopause Mastery. Thank you so much for listening. This is why I do this, and I love sharing information. And I will be back with you next week.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Menopause Mastery podcast. You are why I'm here, and I am so very grateful. Hit subscribe so you don't miss any wisdom on creating the most exceptional life on our terms. If this episode has helped you in any way, please share it with a friend to spread the love, and together we rise. You can follow me on social media at Betty Murray, PhD, and you can reach me online at bettymurray.com.